It was the summer of 1995. I was looking forward to graduating from high school. TLC tried to warn us about chasing waterfalls. Walt Disney Corp. merged with ABC. MTV unleashed road rules upon us. And NBC ruled the airwaves with this unbeatable block of must-see television on Thursday nights with Friends, Seinfeld, and ER. Meanwhile, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, Kevin Costner is putting the final touches on a box office bomb of mass destruction. Lumbering out of the Pacific Rim, the $175 million movie Waterworld, a post-apocalyptic action film directed by Kevin Reynolds and written by Peter Rader and David Tui, among others, arrived on U.S. shores on July 28th and managed to make just $88 million of that back in the U.S. And although it would eventually become profitable with overseas sales, broadcast rights, and home video releases, the troubled production continued Costner's box office decline that began with Wyatt Earp just a year before. His days as a sought-after leading man would come to an end in 1997. Jim, we come here today, 25 years later, after its debut, to pass ultimate judgment on this Waterworld. What say you?
I've passed judgment on Waterworld and it has been found wanting. Waterworld is not a good movie. Waterworld is a movie that is conflicted with itself, that has zero concern for how any of it ever came about to be, both in the production side and the story side. It's somehow a delightfully bad movie, though.
That's what I thought, because I remember I was really pumped for this movie. I was big into science fiction, action adventure. Kevin Costner, leading up to this, had made some really good movies. I really enjoyed Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, in kind of like a trashy, fun, lush big box office way. And I'd also seen Dances with Wolves. My mom liked it. My dad was excited about it. We go to a drive-in theater in the summer of 95 and see this thing on opening night. And I remember like halfway through the second act being like, this is boring. And why is this guy such an asshole? Like,
To be fair, that second act is the weakest part of the movie.
It is really bad, but like watching it again with adult, I think the first act is pretty good. Uh-huh. The third act is pretty entertaining for an adventure romp. It's just the second act fails utterly to get you to care about any of these characters. They're all actively unlikable. Mm-hmm. Like I remember Kevin Costner's Fishman being a big asshole and hard to relate with, but like I didn't think that the girl or the woman of the story, Helen or Enola, was. I thought they were like, I kind of was on Team Costner. Throw these guys overboard. You don't need this shit. As a mariner drifter, like these people don't give a shit about your personal property. They have inflated sense of their self-worth. Get them out of here. Get them out of here. It was tough. But it has a lot of really big ideas, a lot of entertaining action, a memorable villain, and some of the really cool set and costume design and some really cool world building. But boy, as I feel like this is something we've been really beat into our heads the last few weeks, you know, setting a plot is not nearly as important as characters, and the characters just completely fall flat like a underbaked souffle or overbaked souffle. And as a result, as spectacular as the third act is, you just really don't give a shit.
And I think that's why I remember this movie fondly and why I view it, you know, as a delightfully bad movie, because I was 13 when this movie dropped, and I was super excited to see it. It looked like the previews made it look much more exciting. I think than it turned out to be. And I don't know if that's like partially runtime. Maybe they could have cut down a little bit more in that middle section. But I remember being super excited to see it. And when I finally saw it, I remember enjoying the sillier parts of it and enjoying the action and not thinking too much about the characters. Cause I was a kid, you know, that stuff didn't bother me. Nowadays I look at this movie and I go, oh God, this is actually kind of a piece of shit. And I think it's like partially ruined by Dennis Hopper, which,
wow,
you know, this is a performance from Dennis Hopper, and this is kind of just Dennis Hopper, I think, based on what I've seen him in. But like Super Mario Brothers is very in the same vein as his performance, like his King Koopa is very much in the same vein as this performance.
His speed is very much in the same, like, he kind of Pacino'd himself at this point in the 90s, where he was just playing these coked up, half-baked villains.
Like, and not some of them, quite comedy relief. Like, too hard of an edge to be comedy relief, but wanting to be slapstick. It's, the whole movie has that vibe. Like, it wants to be very hard edge, right? It wants to threaten to throw a child overboard to die in the ocean. It also wants you to think that, like, it's funny when a bottle gets smashed in somebody near somebody's face and they have a goofy look on their face, right? Like, there's just this weird juxtaposition of slapstick, weird, silly humor and this hard edge that the movie wants to have, and it doesn't work.
Yeah. And it's kind of, there's a little bit of the Fifth Element DNA in here too, because I feel like the Hopper for a lot of these 90 films is stuck in that same Gary Oldman Zorg, where it's like, this guy is Darth Vader, but he also is Christopher Lloyd, you know?
Sure,
it's like if Christopher Lloyd played Darth Vader, it's like, yeah, okay, he's scary, and the movie's telling me he's scary, and he's got a lot of power, and he's doing a lot of bad things, but the camp factor is really high on these villains,
and
that's
really
fine, but it's a tonal clash, like you said.
Yeah, it's total clash. I guess I didn't remember this movie picking up so quickly. Like, I thought there was a lot more up front. I guess I thought the slowness in the second act was kind of front loaded, and then it really picked up and kicked into gear. But this movie kind of starts very quickly.
Yeah,
like he, you know, gets to this flotilla, this atoll, within the first 10 minutes of the movie. And here's the other thing about this movie that I find absolutely delightful. This movie, in my mind, will forever be and has always been the movie where Kevin Costner drinks his own pee. Because
right off the bat, too.
That opening shot, like, they just zoom in on the world, right? And they come right down to his boat. And they almost come right down to him pissing into this jar. And the camera, you know how they say follow the money? In this movie, it's follow the piss. Because this is a brilliant shot where they're zoomed in on the container as he's peeing into it. As he stops peeing, it goes up to his ass. And then as he zips up, and then he takes the container, pours it in, and the camera is following the jar of piss the entire time. Follows it through the filter. Follows it up to his mouth. It's so good. So good. I could not have been happier as a 13-year-old seeing that.
It's like the oner in Goodfellas, only instead of Ray Liotta, it's just a jar of piss. That intro is really amazing, because, like, the dissolve, and I forgot how it all came together, but it has, like, the, you know, famous Universal classic logo, grainy with the world, and then there's this narrator comes in and says, in the far future, the polar ice caps melt, and you see them melt, and the world kind of start dissolve under it, and now the world's covered in water, and it just keeps zooming in until you're actually in the ocean on the guy's boat. I thought that was really effective, and then it doesn't really kind of stop. He meets a drifter, and then he goes and, or no, he doesn't. He goes to an atoll and does some trading, and then there's like one action scene after another, and then you get to the second act where it's just him and the girl and the little girl, and it grinds to a halt. I got some theories on why that is. Should we, like, how do you want to go with this? Because I haven't even talked about the cast. Like,
let's do that. I was just reminiscing a little bit, but yeah, let's talk about the details.
Yeah, so this film, like I said, was directed by, this movie is directed by Kevin Reynolds, is written by Peter Rader and David Tuohy, but it actually has, like, I think 7 different credited screenwriters, including a very young Joss Whedon.
Jesus, you know, Christ.
We're going to talk about that when we talk about the troubled production. It stars Kevin Costner, who was coming in here pretty hot still. He had like a decade of box office success leading up to this. Let's just start there. 1987's The Untouchables. It's an incredible film. Brian De Palma, love it. 1988, Bull Durham. Not even a baseball fan, pretty good. 1989, Field of Dreams. If you've got a relationship with your dad, it's going to make you cry. 1990, Dances with Wolves. Won tons of Oscars, made tons of money, made people watch a 3.5-hour movie. 1991, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which I got to see that again. I haven't seen it for like 20 years, and I remember this being so much fun. Hmm. 1991 JFK, which we just reviewed, I think, last year, and or maybe the year before that, which, terrible history, but a very entertaining conspiracy film. 1992, The Bodyguard, which I can't even describe to you how big this was. Like, not just in box office, not only in, like, making your mom cream her jeans for Kevin Costner, but the crossover success of Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You, or whatever the hell that song's called. Yeah. Like, it just was a multidimensional ear and mind and eye worm. Mm. And then he hits 94's epic Wyatt Earp, which couldn't even outduel the other movie about Wyatt Earp, Tombstone, mm-hmm. which is the vast superior film. And then he hit Waterworld. And then his career is going to eventually, 2 years later, just be destroyed by another big budget post-apocalyptic film, The Postman. Mm. And he never really recovers from that. Like he does, he had a, would you call it a starring role in 13 Days in 2000?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a kind of like role.
It's an ensemble piece, though. Like, he's kind of playing second fiddle to Bobby and Jack Kennedy and Khrushchev. And then 2016, he had The Hidden Figures, and he's been in the Superman films. But it's his days of as a leading man were firmly over. So he was joined in the starring capacity by Dennis Hopper, who plays the villainous Deacon. Jim didn't like his performance. I thought it was pretty fun. But it is tonally... a big problem in this film.
No, I love it. Like, it's ridiculous. It's perfectly ridiculous, but it doesn't belong in this movie.
Jean Triplehorn, which herself, I think, was having a really nice career up until it hit this film's bump.
She plays Helen. Basic Instinct,
The Firm, Reality Bites. She will achieve small screen success in Big Love on Showtime. Was that Showtime or HBO? I think it was Showtime. Tina Majorino as Enola. Do you know who this is? Where you've seen her elsewise?
I know she does a lot of TV now, but she's also in Napoleon Dynamite 9 years later.
She's Deb from Napoleon Dynamite.
Yeah.
And also Jack Black.
Yeah, as a pilot. Just
one of his first roles, just randomly as a smoker pilot for 2 or 3 minutes in the middle of the second act.
Yeah.
So this, like I said, this movie was, but the thing is, what's weird about this movie, because this is the era when I was reading Starlog and all these science fiction trade mags, everyone felt this was like a soap opera following this production. Like, it was like a big news story about how lavish the production was. It was a big news story about how lavish Kevin Costner's side of the, like, he was staying in a $5,000 a night hotel while his crew was sweltering on the beaches in like ramshackle trailers with internal temperatures 125 degrees. The hurricane destroyed at least one, maybe two. I read conflicting reports, costing like a $20 million rebuild. Just all kinds of problems. It was supposed to be like it ended up being like a 166-day shoot, and it was supposed to be half that. The director went to Steven Spielberg, you know, the other guy who had a famously troubled water production in Jaws, and said, "What is your recommendation for filming on the water?" And Steven Spielberg gave him one simple word of advice: do not shoot on the open water.
Yeah.
The production company ignored that advice and pissed away $175 million on this movie as a result.
We've seen, you know, big tanks used, right? Like, to shoot in controlled circumstances. Like Titanic did a bunch of that. There's so many ways to do this. That could have just involved a matte painting in the back of the horizon.
Yeah.
And the sky, and just shoot it in a controlled environment. Yeah. Could have saved them a lot of money.
And the thing is like, so if you don't know, because this is a 25-year-old movie, but this movie takes place about 500 years in the future after the polar ice caps have completely melted, water covers the entire world, and it's essentially Mad Max on the ocean. That's it. Yeah. There is a chosen child that has a tattoo on her back that might point to the mythical source of dry land, but it's just Mad Max and water. Now, if you're freaking out about global warming, I want to rest assured that if the polar ice caps melt, the oceans rise by like 200-300 feet, not the 4 or 5 miles required to bury, you know, Everest, right?
So no, there is insane.
There is some scientific liberties being taken. Not that like 200 feet rise of ocean wouldn't be catastrophic. Mm-hmm. You know, especially if you're all living by the coast. But
yeah, if you're living in Sweden, it'll be a problem. But
it is an intriguing setup for a movie, and the world I think is fascinating. The world, the cultures, the costuming, and I wanted more and more of that. And apparently, there's a cut that they call the Ulysses cut that started as a fan edit where I guess ABC got the broadcast rights of this and put 40 minutes back into the film, especially in the second act with some stuff amongst the smokers and about their culture and how things kind of work, which might be why the second half is boring. Mm-hmm. Or the second act is boring. But then the studio decided they liked it so much that they duplicated it into a later release of the movie. I've never seen this. I kind of want to now because that's more of the stuff that I wanted to see in the film.
I want to draw a distinction between the art direction, which I think is fantastic, you know, mm-hmm. And the same is true of Mad Max. I think that's fantastic art direction, but I don't want to confuse that with the storytelling and the world building that they do, because I think there is a lot to argue about with the world building and the details of the world they've built.
Yeah. So I thought that maybe we should talk about the movie a little bit, instead of talking around the movie.
Uh-huh.
Do you want to start doing that? Because like I said, I've got tons of materials about like what went wrong and why this movie was like inflated, because again, I think this is the bones of a very good movie. Mm-hmm. And you know, the big problem is Kevin Costner just has zero charisma.
That's the thing. The best thing about a Kevin Costner movie is never Kevin Costner. It's never Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
It's always the movie he's in that carries him.
I wanted to get defensive at Untouchables, but his Elliot Ness is just a piece of drywall.
Yeah, that's like Kevin Costner in a nutshell.
Without Andy Garcia and Sean Connery and Robert De Niro playing out of his mind Capone, that mm-hmm. is a very forgettable movie. So, let's talk about the movie itself. Let's talk about the stuff we really like about it, because the art, like you said, the art direction. This the Mariner, which is the name of Kevin Costner as well. He's got he doesn't have a name, but he's credited as the Mariner. His boat as a sailing aficionado is amazing.
Huh.
And here's the thing that blew me away when I was researching this: it's real. They had two versions of this boat. One that was built explicitly as a racing catamaran that could achieve like speeds of like 45 miles an hour, and then one that had all practical effects like that. Windmill that's retracted into the sail boom, and the boom that shot out of the hull, and the auto deploying sails were all real, and it wasn't as fast as the racing boat, but it could actually sail.
Huh.
That is fucking amazing. And someone bought that boat and it's still in private hands operating somewhere.
Nice.
Like, I couldn't believe that shit all worked. It's like something out of Knight Rider or like an animated film, like that show I used to like in the 80s, Mask. Like, mm-hmm. I just couldn't believe that this stuff was all. I mean, I figured it was all practical because this was right at the shaky edge of like digital effects. But the fact that they built that and actually worked, it was a working sailing boat, that just blew me away. And it made sense too, because the story of this guy's a fish man that can dive down in the shallow seas and retrieve like precious artifacts. And he would like, because at first I'm thinking like, well, how does Mad Max, like it'd be like have Mad Max having this like battle fortress that he could privately finance. But Kevin Costner could do that because he's like the wealthiest man on Waterworld. So he's got the best boat. He's got the best material. He's got the thing perfectly set up to be the loner character that he is. Mm-hmm. And I really like that setup.
Nothing exemplifies his wealth and assurity of comfort better than him eating the leaves off a tomato plant. I feel like that's the least useful, the least productive use of a tomato plant is to mm-hmm. eat the leaves off of it and kill it.
I thought that there's a couple of points where like he's got this bonsai tree that's growing like four or five large limes.
Uh-huh.
Is that even physically possible? It's a cool idea, but holy hell.
Yeah. I mean, they wouldn't be big limes, but they would be certainly limes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that you'd have to have something to like stave off scurvy or whatnot.
Yeah.
Like they had answers to all this stuff. It's just like, just on my edge of believability for some of these things. Like, you know, how are people eating? I guess I never felt like food was a problem because they're on the ocean. With humanity being destroyed, I imagine there's just like teeming life that you could, you know, like you could catch fish. You could do all kinds of different things. You could eat algae, seaweed. And freshwater, like if you can process urine, you can certainly desalinate seawater. So to me, like the problem of this world is like raw materials. But I was flabbergasted to see like that seems to be the one problem they don't have. Like building and maintaining enormous steel structures, not a problem. It's food, it's fresh food and fresh water that's the problem for these people. Does it not rain in Waterworld, paradoxically?
Yeah, maybe not. I don't know. There are a lot of strange things about Waterworld. But yeah, I think they do a pretty good job explaining most of the stuff that they want to do in this. I was kind of impressed when they said, okay, well, the Mariner is able to, you know, dive underwater and get these artifacts and trade up for stuff. Now, I'm not sure what the value of these things is to the people who are not the Mariner. Like, why would you ever trade any food or any water for a pile of dirt? I understand the novelty of seeing it, but it's completely useless.
Well, don't they like growing things like on these atolls? Like, I guess I thought that dirt would be prized because you could actually grow tomatoes and things like that.
Paper,
that's the thing that blew my mind. Like,
it makes no sense.
Because talking about like the costuming, I kept on noticing how like their costumes were made out of either fish skin or things that would float in water. Like, there's a lot of like what do they call those plastic rings that hold like six packs together?
Yeah.
There's a lot of those kind of braided together in vests and like little bits of plastic and things like that. Stuff that would float on an ocean. It made sense that dirt was valuable, but then why, like, you know, 5 pounds of dirt is worth 2 pounds of water? That didn't make sense to me because, like, again, it didn't seem like water would be in a short supply. It's so easy to make fresh water. Sure. Like, you either catch it in rain, you can, you know, heat things up and, you know, purify it through steam. There's like just tons of ways to desalinate water, especially with a reduced human population. But, you know, getting raw materials and all that kind of stuff, I thought the economy was a little fucked up. But I also really liked just going with the world, the idea that they have like all these rituals about reclaiming bodies.
Yeah.
Like their prayers were all about, you know, like bones to bread, veins to vines, stuff like this. And as they lower your body into this organic soup that dissolves it. And then, you know, I don't know, they make soil. Who knows what they do with all that? But I thought that stuff was really pretty cool. The idea that anytime a trader would come in that was impressive genetic stock, that you'd want to like have your daughters breed with him, essentially, because things get weird when it's just all kept in the atoll. Like, I thought some of that stuff was kind of cool. But then, you know, the smokers. Do you want to talk about the smokers a bit?
Sure. Yeah, those are the people who, well, it's revealed over the course of the movie what their fuel source is, which is just eye-rollingly bad, in my opinion. But because it's just so silly. But those are the people who are addicted to fuel, and actually in some cases, in the case of Deacon, Dennis Hopper's character, hates people who don't use fuel, has an active hatred of sales, as he claims in the film. And I don't know why. Did a sale kill his mother? I don't know.
This has just got to be cultural commentary, right? The fact that like fuel and hydrocarbons
are the bad guy is obsessed with it.
Yeah, like it's carbon dioxide is what's killing, pollution's what's killing the planet. So the bad guy's got to be, he's essentially a Captain Planet villain, right? His homeland is the, and this is something else revealed throughout the movie, they're living on the old Exxon Valdez.
Which
ran onto a reef and polluted like thousands and thousands of miles of pristine Alaskan wilderness. They got a picture of the captain that did it.
Yeah.
Joseph Hazelwood framed, and they call him Saint Joe, and he gets inspiration from this asshole that I think this guy was drunk at the time that the thing was ran aground and did all. So it's like there's like this guy was a personal villain too at the time. So I think because not only were they like their name's smokers because they're running on poorly refined crude oil. Mm-hmm. So like all their shit just literally smokes and is like very inefficient. But they also are in possession of an enormous amount of cigarettes, an enormous amount of alcohol. They're mm-hmm. like all of humanity's vices distilled sure. into this one boat of like inbred despotism.
Yeah.
And it's a really cool idea for a villain. And I think that Dennis Hopper is a pretty good, does a pretty good job at that. But there's a couple of ridiculous things like towards the end of the film where they're going to take off towards dry land and they're just trying to row this thing.
Uh-huh. They're rowing an oil tanker. Yeah. Why not?
I mean, it's bonkers. It's crazy, but hell, it might work. I love the idea that like this thing's been floating for maybe 500 years and there's like 30 feet of barnacle crust at the end of it. Like mm-hmm. how fast can they get going with these oars? Like,
I'm convinced 3 miles an hour. Yeah, there's no steel under there. It's more barnacle than boat now. Like,
yeah, probably
hundreds of years. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, they said it's 500. Like, and I don't even know there'd be that much superstructure left after 500 years of just constant salt water. You know, they don't understand, like, because, like, I think modern ships have these like sacrificial zinc anodes that like take all of the galvanic corrosion and like they concentrate at one point, those things burn out. Like they literally like that's a solid bar of zinc that just gets corroded and like there's no way these guys are going to be smart enough to keep up on that. So how the hell does this boat even start? But on the other hand, it is like it's essentially like a screen door at this point, like the old joke, and you might be right, the barnacles are what's keeping it afloat at this point. Dennis Hopper is cool, but all of his lieutenants suffer from the commando problem. Like his right-hand man looks like the brother of the hamburger salad that the ham salad sandwich that plays the second banana to the commando. The guy wearing the fishnet, Bennett.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, he's the bastard brother of Bennett. Like he just is a big beefy red-faced dude on the ocean waves and he's not intimidating. Like when you got a 12-year-old girl and you're threatening to flay her alive to get her back tattoo off so you can stretch it out and examine it, there should be some kind of fear that that might take place, but the little girl's not afraid. I'm not afraid. These guys, like, I don't even, if Kevin Costner doesn't show up, I don't think they got the heart to do it. Uh-huh. They're all talk. They're all bark and no bite. Does Dennis Hopper do anything, like, really psychotic in this film other than just engage in war on the open sea, you know?
I guess the bodies that he uses to try and trick, like he kills a bunch of people on this little buoy thing and then tricks them into thinking that, you know, they're coming to a place of security, and then I mean it's implied that he killed those people, right? And then this is pretty macabre, using their bodies to wave it.
But it's so for it's so it's such a such a remove. I think it's very similar to like the Starbase scene in Wrath of Khan, where like you realize that Khan has come and like strung up and bled out all these Federation scientists, and it's filmed as a horrific realization.
Yeah.
But these guys being used as human marionettes are almost kind of like funny in the Pirates of the Caribbean way.
Right. That's what I mean. Like they mix this hard edge with a silliness. Way too often for there to ever be any real sense of danger. The other thing I guess you could say is he's got some guy who's most certainly going to die soon regardless down in the fuel tanks, sort of like dipsticking the thing to measure constantly.
He's just the keeper of the level of black stuff.
That's fucked up. That's dark.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty grim. Like, this guy just lives on a boat and he, like, I guess subsists. A boat within a boat, and he subsists on the spit of Dennis Hopper.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's his, like, it's kind of like there's an Immortan Joe to, like, you know, I don't want you to get too addicted to this hydro, so here, open your mouth, I'm going to spit into it. There's your payment for today.
And then, I mean, it's real dark when the boat explodes, like, and the guy sees the explosion coming, he's like, oh, thank God.
Yeah.
That's dark.
I'm being called home.
Yeah.
So we slid into talking bad mouth in the movie again. I will say this.
Oh, I have more of that.
I can't believe how inventive the stunts are. Like anything you can do on the water, water skiing, jet skiing, ski doing, boating, hydroplaning, planing, Water skiing behind a plane, doing complicated water skiing stunts off ramps,
kite sailing,
bungee jumping from a hot air airship into the water to retrieve, like, every single thing you can possibly do on the water, because there is no land. You're not going to be able to go to some like kind of like fortress, like I guess the Exxon Valdez with the exception. Like, everything you can do on the water, like underwater jet ski stunts and ambushes and stuff. That stuff was all was really, really cool. And whoever had the, like, we could start off with whiteboards, like, okay, boys, throw me some watercraft and what you can do with them. And there are no wrong answers, and we're going to fit every one of these things into this fucking movie. That's had to be like how it went down, because God, they did it all. They did it all.
They really did. And I actually saw, within the last 5 years, I saw the Universal Studios live show, live production of Waterworld, which is in this big, like, SeaWorld-esque aquarium kind of theater. And it's got a big set that's built up like the Atoll in Waterworld. And there are just insane stunts that they do. I was super impressed by the Waterworld live show. If you ever get a chance, don't sleep on that. It's really fucking good.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's lunch 420, which, given last weekend, seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah, well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Another thing I really liked about the world building is when the Mariner takes Helen below seas to show like where dry land is, you know, like, and you get to go through this like ghostly city that's partially collapsed. There's a submarine that sank through it. I thought that was pretty effective. I mean, it's clearly just like green screen, but it's weird green, like it's underwater green screen. He's actually swimming. They just digitally composited this background. And that's probably, I remember, like, when I think about this movie before I watched it again, I started thinking about, okay, what do I remember about this? And I remember Kevin Costner pissing into the jug and processing his own urine. I remembered Gene Triplehorn's ass. Okay. And I remember this underwater scene. Everything else was kind of like a mishmash. Like, I knew kind of roughly what happened and like the arc of the movie, but those are the visuals that kind of stood out for me. And that scene still pretty much holds up, you know, like you could do it a little bit better. Like, The Phantom Menace, when the Jedi go swim down to the Gungan city, is it 10 times better?
I mean, Aquaman is 10 times better, sure.
Aquaman, is it 10 times better?
The compositing was pretty rough in this. Oh,
they also they showed the effect of Kevin Costner swimming very fast. They're probably just towing him, with a rope, but he's porpoising, and there's a couple shots where I think it's practical. And they used, I think his name's Laird Hamilton, the famous big wave surfer, to do all this underwater stunt work for Kevin Costner. But it looks really good. He believably swims very, very fast. Like you would think a fish man could.
Yeah. No, it's true. Man, I have so many complaints. So many complaints about this movie.
Do you have no more positive things to say about it? No more positive things.
There's not a lot to say about this aside from the art direction being great.
Yep.
The story being, I don't know. The story is fine.
The story's fine.
The world building is good, though it's completely unbelievable. The scenes you're talking about, you mentioned how even all the water in the world, ice caps melted, everything wouldn't raise the sea level more than 200 something feet. And in this, we see it's thousands of feet. Yeah. What happened? Did we, they talk about all the things we did, the ice caps melting, but there had to be something else. Did we go out and grab a bunch of glaciers from space and bring them back?
Yeah.
Oops.
A couple comets.
Too much water.
Smacked into it. Yeah.
Didn't think that would happen. So there's a shot with an enormous moon, just an enormous moon. It's 1500 times the size of our moon. Did we pull the moon too close? Is this a tidal thing? Is it pulling water up?
I did research on this, and apparently there was an early art direction that depicted two moons to show that they're the Earth somehow captured some other giant planetoid going through, and
span of time.
Yeah, we'd captured another moon, and that was messing up the tides and stretching out the water. But that just implies that you just need to keep sailing, because you'll eventually get to the bulgy part where the dry land's being exposed.
Fair, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where the hell it's been said that if you ironed out all the wrinkles on the Earth, so it's the water would perfectly cover the surface for pretty far depth. So maybe there's some plate tectonics at work too. Once the ice rolled off of the Antarctic, that shit started bulging and flattening out and stuff. I don't know.
Maybe you could explain that stuff, but they didn't explain it in the movie. And B, the scene that you're talking about with the underwater swimming, he's dragging her into crush depth. This shit, I've seen The Abyss, mm-hmm. right? You can't, mm-hmm. a human body can't go much more than 50, 60 feet underwater, a bare human body, without suffering extreme health effects. So and you die. You go as deep as she did without any apparatus or anything, you're dead.
Yeah, I mean, because in the real life bathyspheres that they had air supplies as you went down deeper, because the water pressure increases and that bubble gets smaller and smaller, so you release more air, it displaces more water. They didn't have that, so yeah,
something with that. She's looking at a gauge. The kid is looking at a gauge.
I thought that was just a depth gauge.
I thought so too. Which
it was implied that it was either the 700 feet or meters. Either one, it's way too deep to just do a simple dive bell that they've got. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, you can't do it. It's there are so many things like that in this movie that I just don't understand.
And the thing is you could easily, all these things could have been fixed, because you would overlook all these with the rule of cool, but this movie's just not that cool.
Right.
It wants to be, and it carries itself with that swagger, but it always comes back to me, Kevin Costner is just a wet piece of seaweed. Mm-hmm. He's literally wet. The entire movie, he's wet. There's interviews of him bitching about, in between every take, they dump a bucket of water over his head because he's supposed to be wet the entire time. He's a fish man. But he's literally a soggy fucking mayonnaise sandwich in this film, and he also is playing this guy with an edge, which, to be fair, I guess is a mutant who gets hounded from atoll to atoll you would probably get pretty sick of humans' shit.
Yeah.
But then inexplicably, they make Gene Triplehorn and the girl Enola, they're big assholes too. Like, in a post-apocalypse, I don't buy that children would just be unmitigated brats. The world's too harsh and violent for kids to grow up with this kind of entitlement thing. And the idea that like she would say like, "Hey, I'll let you out of here if and you can give us free room and board," and then her think that that's it, like she's doesn't that this guy's like can't throw us overboard because he I don't know, it's weird because she like grew up on this shitty world, but like they act like they didn't. They act like they are late 20th century people that just beam down, and they're like both like Karens that are just shocked and upset at the service that they're getting on the sailing vessel that they have hired. It's just really and like so much of the drama in the second half is generated by their stupidity. You know, like he's trying to solve a problem and Gene Triplehorn gets on the harpoon gun and fucks everything up and destroys his boat. His reaction to that.
That's fine.
Right, but his reaction to that is to cut their hair?
Yeah, this is weird. One of the major problems in the second act that just does not feel right is just what the line they're trying to draw between him being a good guy and a bad guy, right? Like,
yes.
There's some mix that they're going for here, some hard edge they're trying to find on the Mariner, but it never manifests, really. Like, it's all just, like, looks and threats and stuff like that, where he has no reason to take them along in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there is a series of moments where he's kind of saved by them, like the gate thing.
Yeah, yeah.
He's right. He's got to go up and help them.
She lets him out of the cage. That's it. That's as far as I can tell. The only thing that they did, they half opened the door. He had to finish the rest. Like
right.
They're
trying to do this thing where like there's a weird, weird, weird romance here, that is just kind of gross. And B, doesn't really strike me as any of their characters. Like it just isn't played right.
Well, like here, you know, Han Solo, anti-hero, shoots people first in bars, is all about the money, doesn't have a lot of principles, but he didn't try to sell Leia into sexual slavery.
Right. He didn't actually, and crucially, like, Mariner goes through with that, but then
because the paper wasn't up to snuff, or he felt like and the reason that he's not just a complete villain is because he refused to sell the girl into the 12-year-old girl into sexual slavery.
Uh-huh.
It is rough, and then they turn that corner into like a romance that never really gets requited because he's a fish man and he's got to go back to the sea, I guess, at the end.
Right,
and that's the end I thought was unsatisfying because he has to go away, but why? Like, this isn't like Shane, he's wanted for murder and he's got to go back or he's going to, like, you know, swing from the gallows or whatever. It's like, well, I helped you get to dry land, but I'm a fish man. I belong at sea. Like, are you never going to come back here for trade? This is dry fucking land. Like, come back. Here's where you get your limes, buddy, and your fresh water. Like, this is your new base of operations. Yeah, go out and roam to sea. Maybe spread the gospel of dry land far and wide. But, like, why is this a goodbye? A permanent goodbye.
Yeah, it shouldn't need to be. And I think, like, the whole idea of the mountaintop utopia is truly ridiculous in this world. Like, this implies a scenario in which the ice caps melted so rapidly that no one thought to go to higher ground. Like, literally, our society just said, oh, shit, here comes the water. We're done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, Jeff Bezos didn't try. Elon Musk didn't try. Nobody tried to get to higher ground. That is the literal first thing you do when the water is coming. Get to higher ground.
All the wealthy scientific and literate people are living on the moon and Mars. This it is just the dregs of humanity left behind. That's why they're all assholes. That's why they're all
moon,
like, off-putting.
A space station. That's no moon.
It's a space station. Did you know that location, I put in my notes, is like, is this supposed to be Mount Everest? Like, this is like, you know, and it is like that tattoo in his back. If you decipher all the kanji and the glyphs, that it is coordinates that point exactly to Mount Everest. So okay. It is. But you're right. Like there should be tons of humans there, and
this should be the most populated place on the planet.
And there was human population, but they died out. They were doomed. Why are you doomed? You're the ones that have like still dry land and fresh water.
Right.
And their response to being doomed is to tattoo babies and send them out in buckets of dirt on, cast them away like Moses or fucking Kal-El from Krypton.
Yeah. Get like, rid of all the things that will sustain our society here and our population.
Yeah.
Just send them out to the wasteland.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe there's because I hear that there's the Ulysses cut is named because there's a whole bunch of stuff in the denouement where, you know, she gives him a name, Ulysses, and tells him about the Odyssey and that he's leaving because he knows there's other clans of mutants out there and he wants to tell them about where they can find refuge amongst dry land. And but I wonder how many other of these problems that longer cut fixes. And I paradoxically, I guess the director wanted to have the 3-hour cut, but Kevin Costner refused because he thought the reason why ERP failed is because it was like 3.5 hours long. So he's like, well, I don't want to make 2 3-plus-hour bombs in a row. And in fact, I guess the director walked off the set like 2/3 of the way through production, and Kevin Costner directed the last bit of the third of the movie.
The fuck?
The director was quoted as saying, Kevin Costner should only star in movies he directs. That way he can work with his favorite actor and favorite director.
Jesus.
And I guess this guy also, do you want to talk more about the movie, or do you want to talk about the, do you have anything? Because I want to talk about like all the research I did on all the things that went wrong with the production of this thing.
Yeah, hit me.
Okay, so in no particular order, one of the things I alluded to in the beginning is the inequity of this production. You had Kevin Costner staying at a $5,000 a night villa on the coast of Hawaii with a butler and a chef, and all the crew were living on these little huts that didn't have air conditioning, and I guess it was like getting like 120 degrees during the daytime, so that like you had like bad feelings between the production and the star and then the director of the piece. The director and him, so this is the same guy that directed Prince of Thieves. I didn't know this, but I guess him and Kevin Costner butted heads throughout that, and he swore never to work with him again, but the producer got them both in a room and kind of settled the hash, but that didn't last throughout the film, the entire filming. So Kevin Costner has to take this thing over. The script had 36 different drafts involving 6 different writers. Joss Whedon came out for the rewrite crucial scenes in the final weeks of shooting. And I guess what he said is like Kevin Costner essentially held a gun to his head and insisted all of his notes get put into the script. So Joss just was like cleaning up Kevin Costner dialogue and Kevin Costner plotting.
Ugh.
Because that's the other thing is like this was written as a lighthearted children's movie. And when Kevin Costner took it over, he said, I want this to be a serious action film. So they injected a bunch of grimdark into it. And I think that explains a lot of like the clash of tone.
Yep. Okay. Because I see it now.
On a surface level, it's very grim, but there is nothing grim that really happens.
Yeah.
Neither the main set that weighed over 30 tons and was also wrecked. This is, I think, that either the atoll, one of the atolls. So there's a whole plot of the slavers. You hear this mentioned. You got the smokers and the slavers. I guess the set that the slavers action piece was supposed to happen on sank, and they didn't have enough money to rebuild it because the atoll set had previously sunk and they rebuilt it. So they just cut that part out of the movie. But none of these sets nor any of the 30 boats they used had bathrooms. So they had to stop and ferry people on boats to these floating portalettes that they had anchored off the coast.
Just hang your ass over the boat edge.
And
like,
at 165 days, why don't you just bring those bathrooms closer? Can you not fit a portalette inside this atoll set? I don't like this is shit that like, oh, here's another thing. The crew, so they're deciding whether they want to film this off the coast of Australia or the coast of Hawaii. And they decided on Hawaii because at the time they wanted to film it, it was going to be winter in Australia. But they did no research. And during the time that they filmed this in Hawaii, the prevailing winds were 40 to 50 miles an hour. So they were constantly blowing the sets out of range, constantly blowing things out of shots. Like, in fact, in the movie, you can see several points where the set had drifted off to where you could see dry land in the background. Like, on the edge of the shot, you can see, like, mountains and cliffs of Hawaii. Yeah, I did too. But, like, I guess then that's because, like, well, fuck it. We're just going to get this shot. So that was a problem. Kevin Costner demanded in post-production that the VFX crew hide his receding hairline digitally.
They failed. Like,
they totally failed.
One of my biggest nightmares now is Kevin Costner swimming at me underwater with his stringy hair plastered back to his head. It's like it's right up there with the baby in Train Spotting as my biggest nightmare.
But man, this cost.
It's bad.
It's bad, and this is 95, so digital stuff was really in its infancy, and it cost like several million dollars just to poorly hide his balding spots.
Just give up some of your vanity or wear a wig if you want that to be covered up.
They shut down filming three different stretches because of hurricane season. They had to do that. Mark Isham. So one of my complaints of the film is I thought the score was very vanilla and boring. And then I started researching this stuff, and it turns out that they originally hired this guy named Mark Isham to write the score. Kevin Costner got it, and he goes, "Well, this is too moody and ethnic for the movie that I'm trying to make." So they hired, I think, James Horner at the last minute to come in and just do a bare bones vanilla action movie score. Like, yeah. It's this almost is like something you can get out of Adobe's licensed material. It's just an action movie score. There's nothing Waterworld. There's no distinct like themes for characters and stuff. It's just an action thing.
They're not like playing plastic bottles as drums or anything in the tracks.
No. And I'm like, it's like too ethnic. One of the coolest things about this film is like they had that kind of Firefly shit where it's like a blend of Polynesian and different languages, and they had this own kind of like belter, you know, patois, this Creole language, and like Kevin's, and instead of leaning into that and how distinct and melting pot it is, they're like,
I mean, the central tension of the movie, will they find dry land, is solved by a Rosetta Stone, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, yeah.
Yeah, how could the sound of this movie possibly be too ethnic?
I don't know, but that was what Kevin Costner's opinion.
And that's hilarious because this movie won was nominated for an Oscar for best sound. So like you've got the soundtrack in juxtaposition to the actual sound of the movie.
Yeah. And I think I watched it with my surround sound system, and like it did, like there's some cool effects. Like I noticed, like when they harpooned the plane, I just noticed little stuff like that, the twanging of the cables and the creaking of the various sets and stuff. There was, I thought like the explosion effects of like the final set piece where the Exxon Valdez gets flared to death. That stuff was always really cool, but I don't know. I mean, just boy, that last act, if the last act had been preceded by a decent second act, I think it would have worked really well, because that like speech that the girl gives about like, oh, when the Mariner gets here, you're so fucked because he's done this and he's done that. We haven't really seen him do anything, but like,
yeah.
Like stuff out of like a sitcom. Like he's just putting out fires and shit on his boat that his stowaways have caused. Like he's being flummoxed, and he does weird things where like they just get away from the smokers, and Gene Triplehorn gives him a little bit of lip about like dry land. He's like, I'll show you dry land. He takes her under this underwater odyssey, and he gets back, and of course the smokers are there. And they're there to fuck him because, like, of course they are. You just barely escape them on your fucking sailboat, and they've got speedboats, dude.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most hilarious thing is the sailboat running from these jet skis.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Okay, maybe a jet ski on the best windy day, but
right.
You're not getting away from, you know, a powerboat.
Yeah, especially if you have to flee into the wind, you're going to be fucked. Yeah.
I mean, they could just flank you and you're done. So
yeah, but I don't know. What else do you got to say for
I mean, there's a couple of funny moments. Like, I don't hate the comedy in this. I just think it's misplaced. There are, you know, I talked a little bit about the speech that he's giving at the end, which is, you know, all bluster and bullshit. He hasn't actually figured this the cipher out. But while he's giving that speech, he's like, he smashes a bottle on the railing and it like shoots glass into the eyes of the guy behind him, who gives a weird reaction. He fires a gun in the same guy's face. There's a moment where they're trying to take off that biplane on the oil tanker. And Kevin Costner pulls the bottom of it off, right? And then it goes smashing into a wall at what has to be at least 60 miles an hour, no seatbelts.
Right.
Girl, totally fine. But she face plants right into the steel wall. I thought that was hilarious.
Dennis Hopper getting fitted with this prosthetic eye. Dennis Hopper getting fit with his prosthetic eye, I thought was pretty funny.
Oh, God. And then they leave the eyelashes in the whole movie. It's incredible. Incredibly hilarious.
It looks like he's got some kind of like fucking fly bait or whatever, fly fishing lure stuck underneath his eye or something.
What looks worse, Kevin Costner's stringy hair or those eyelashes?
Well, I don't know, because it's like, who knows what horror show it looked like before they digitally altered it. But every time I saw a close up of Dennis Hopper's face with those things sticking out from his eye patch, it did give me the heebie jeebies for sure.
Yeah. And some of the stuff I like the his eye patch is like a pair of half blacked out swim goggles.
Yep.
It's just like, that makes total sense in this world. There's some stuff that also doesn't feel fleshed out. Like the romance doesn't feel fleshed out enough. Some of the details of like, how did Waterworld happen, don't feel fleshed out. But mutants are a thing that's like in this world, but not really explained or not integrated well. I mean, it half is. It's much like, you know, the him being a bad guy versus a good guy. It's like, it's in there, but it doesn't feel right the way they incorporated it. Like, mutants are a thing that people notice and a thing that people hate, but he's really the only one we see. And yes, he uses those mutant powers to like get all the things he's got, but I don't feel like the mutants were much of a thing in the movie.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that I wonder if that's because, again, that Ulysses cut had alluded to colonies of mutants. It's also like, why would they be hostile towards that? You'd think, like, if I am on Waterworld and I see a guy with gills and webbed feet that can, like, is essentially a Superman, I would want my daughters to breed with them even more.
Yeah.
Because I want my grandkids to have fish parts.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, I don't know, like maybe he's got like a big spiny fish dick and it's going to be a problem. But like, don't you want, like, that's the future of humanity, it seems like, on this world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although I also wonder, like, if carbon just plummeted to zero and the world is ocean covered the earth, and presumably like algae and plankton, which does the real heavy lifting of oxygen production on the earth, I wonder how like fast it would revert back to like when the polar caps would start reforming and all that kind of stuff. Cause, you know, like, I was just wondering, like, man, what would this do to like wind currents and rainfall and all that? Like, what would it do to the climate? Is like the whole world tropical now? Like, but I also like wonder how long it would take for that to revert back to the olden days.
I don't think the movie has thought about that. The movie just said, this is a cool idea for an action movie. Let's do it.
Yes. And that's what I read, that this was originally conceived in the 80s during the heyday of Mad Max. And they're like, literally, how can we rip off Mad Max? What's the opposite of a desert world? Water world, baby, over cocktails. And then they spent like the next 7 years trying to get it made. And Kevin Costner's like, yes, that's the one for me. I want it done.
Yeah. It's equivalent of The Day After Tomorrow in its conception,
scientific rigor. It's like, I don't think they did research on the weather, because they didn't even research the volume of ice and how much water it would make if it melted in the poles, and that information was readily available. I mean, this is in the days where I think I don't know, because I would used to be conservative, it's hard for me to say, but like, I felt like public opinion was much more that global warming was a bunch of nonsense than it is now, where it's like, still, a lot of people think it's nonsense, but I think the preponderance of people have switched over and said, nah, nah, it's actually something happening. Mm-hmm. What else do you want to, what else you got?
Oh, I couldn't help but notice everybody's tans in this movie. Like, everyone is like deeply tanned. And I don't know if they sought out actors. I don't think of Kevin Costner as a guy with a deep tan. I think of him kind of the opposite, actually. So did they have him tan for this? Did they spray tan everyone? Dennis Hopper, too, is very tan.
I hard disagree. Every film I've ever seen him in, he's sporting a glowing bronze tan.
Really? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Maybe I'm not a
Kevin Costner fan to, he's got, to know got the a tone weather of his skin.
But he does. He's got, like, everyone looks like they got sunburnt cheeks and, like, wind-burnt, water-burnt, sunburnt faces. Like, that felt pretty right to me.
Yeah, it's part of that really good art direction. And then just a piece of meta, since we've talked about Star Wars a couple of times now in this movie. Did you notice that when you get the overhead shot of the atoll, that it is shaped like the Millennium Falcon?
No, like, I did not.
Got the two things kind of jutting out in the front and the rounded structure and then maybe like a flat spot in the back. It's I think that was intentional, but I don't know why.
That's pretty cool.
So
plain homage to, like, you know, like that's I don't know, maybe it's a Starlog thing where it's like you wanna get you wanna get positive press in the nerd press, you lean in and put a Star Wars reference so that everyone writes about it and gets people all hyped up. And Starlog and Fangoria. But yeah, I don't know. It's like I would be very interested to see a remake of Waterworld, because again, I think it's a really cool idea. And it is a neat concept, and the world building and art design are spot on. And with now modern digital effects, you could do this for so much cheaper. And really, if you just recast and rewrote the characters, where he's not as big of an ass, he's more of a Han Solo type. He's not as big of an asshole. The he's more charmed by the, because there's like also like I don't understand why he turned around on these people. Mm-hmm. There was nothing like, oh, you can't swim? Well, I'll teach you how to swim, and that's going to turn everything around. And that's what made Gene Triplehorn's character start to be attracted to him and see him not as a threat, like. But that came essentially out of nowhere. Like, they never stopped antagonizing and pissing him off and wrecking things. And in return, he became ever more capricious and violent towards them.
Right. Until he wasn't.
The hair cutting scene, just so bizarre. What the fuck? So weird.
Kevin Costner was like, no one on this set is going to have better hair than me.
You know what? I noticed that. Like, no one in this production has good hair. No one.
No.
Like, it's all, you know, that's fine, kind of like a Mad Max thing. Like, no one's got product or whatever, but, like, everyone's hair is a complete disaster. The costumes are cool, but the hair is just all, like, blown out and frizz.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's what they did. The whole 160-day shoot, no one is allowed to use fresh water or shampoo. It's just everybody's salt-crusted and briny. Like a pickle. They're all like a pickle.
Authentic, damn it.
Yeah, damn straight. We're going to keep it, speaking of briny, keeping of ocean theme, that we're going to keep it that way because we're going to see The Hunt for Red October, one of my all-time favorite movies, based on one of my all-time favorite books. I'm really excited to revisit. I haven't seen it in probably a decade, but I'm going to strongly suspect that it holds up. If you've never seen this movie, I really recommend it. It's a taut political thriller. It's got a lot of cool action scenes. It stars a very young Alec Baldwin and a really at his height of People Magazine Sexiest Man Alive, Sean Connery. It's a really good movie, and I'm really excited to watch it next week. That's what we'll be doing next week on Bald Move Prestige. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.